Today is August 3rd, 1973. This is Mike Dalton in Fairbanks. I just wanted to make a few comments on my trip to Rampart. Rampart is located maybe 75 miles upstream from Tanana on the Yukon River. Tanana is located where at the confluence of the Tanana and Tanana and the Yukon Rivers. At this time in Rampart, there are probably 15 or 16 family units, making a population of, this is a guesstimate of some of the people there, around maybe 45 or 50 people. That's just a guess. I'd have to look it up to be sure of the population. At any rate, Rampart began because of gold. A half-breed Russian Indian named Minook in 1896 was discovering gold on what is called Big Minook Creek, about the same time that Carmack and Skookum Jim were discovering gold on the Klondike. Traces of gold had been found in the Rampart area around 1893, according to some information I've read. The town was a booming gold rush town, and by 1898-99, it was a huge city, huge for Alaska, that is. Mrs. Antoinette Woods, whom I interviewed, was born on the Yukon River and moved to Rampart when she was three. She was born in 1894, and she recalls Rampart as being maybe 10,000 people. I'm sure she gets that figure from hearsay in the city of Rampart. Another person, the commissioner, Harry Haverlock, estimated the town was as population went up as high as 6,000 during the height of the gold rush there. The noise in the background of the two tapes I made where I interviewed Antoinette Wood was Mrs. Kitty Harwood and Mrs. Pauline Carlo cooking dinner. On Tuesday, July 24th, a Rampart man, 29-year-old Alvin Henry, was drowned. His empty boat, his belongings were found on an island which is just upstream from the Rampart village. And some said he'd been drinking. At any rate, his boat was found and his belongings in it, and his lighter was open as if he'd stood up and as if he was lighting a cigarette. They theorized that he fell out and hit his head and then was knocked unconscious and fell in the river. If I heard it once, I must have heard it a dozen times over the weekend, that it's too early to look for his body, that the body doesn't come up until 9 or 10 days after it falls in the river. And this is just a fact that the Indians know, and one of the gauges they use for searching. However, the search began immediately and continued, and it continued on until Friday, yesterday, the 2nd of August, when the body of Alvin Henry was found down near Tanana. And sure enough, it was 10 days. According to one Indian lady there, the reason this happens is that the spleen, this is the way she explained it to me, and this is certainly no medical authority on this, would bear checking out. The spleen bursts, causes probably gas in the body has formed and causes the body to rise. The water in the Yukon River is extremely cold. However, it's not as cold as some of the lakes and nearby streams. Last year there was a drowning in a lake near Rampart. Last year, the year before, it was a boy, maybe, I don't know how old he was, a young boy. And the villagers dragged the lake until they found his body. When they found it, they brought it up. It was perfectly preserved. The water was so cold that his body was just perfectly preserved. This information came from two different sources there who live in, people who live in Rampart. When I went to Rampart, one of the people I wanted to interview was Ira Wiesner. He's the trader. He's been in Rampart since 1942. But I flew over on Fort Yukon Air Service airplane, and on board was Lucy Ann Carlo, and her father and mother were already in Rampart, as were her three brothers. And Lucy just, Ann they call her. Ann went over just for the day and evening, was returning Sunday to Fairbanks, and then was going to drive back to Anchorage, where she works for, I think it's the Alaska Federation of Natives. At any rate, we landed, and the airport taxi, which is about a 15-year-old Chevrolet pickup, blue, miscellaneous dents had been banged back out. It came down to the airplane, and there must have been 15 people hanging on the running board, the back bumper, and in the body of the pickup. The driver of this pickup and the man who meets all the airplanes and gets the mail back and forth to the aircraft and to the post office, which is in Wiesner's store, is named Daniel Wheel. Everybody calls him Danny. The Carlos had an old Jeep there, and I put all my gear in that, and we were going to drive it to town, but it wouldn't start, and just about the time we were playing around with it, in comes Bill Carlo in his own aircraft with his son Manny. They'd been up the river to the site of the TAPS road, Trans-Alaska Pipeline System road, which goes from the Livengood Road on up to the Yukon River. That's where a barge carrying his heavy equipment for road building was. And they were having a few problems, like, well, I guess they loaded the barge there. And then one of the big, huge scrapers became stuck, so Bill had to go up and dig it out. We ended up, someone got the Jeep going, and but Bill and Ann and I walked to town and noticed that Ann had a 357 Magnum in a holster and on a belt. She had that slung over her shoulder. Her dad had had it in the airplane with him. She carried it in town. We walked all the way in town. Just before we got into not even a mile. The airstrip is about maybe a mile from the village. Just as we were getting close to the village, Bill started telling me about Wiesner having a little altercation with his son. According to Bill's story, his son Stewie went in the store to buy some cigarettes and candy and asked Wiesner to charge it on his charge account. Everybody there has a charge account. Darn near everybody. And Wiesner said he doesn't use a profane word, namely shit. Said that he didn't charge cigarettes and candy and shit like that. And Stewie popped off, and Wiesner reached down and grabbed his pistol and by the barrel and whopped Stewie over the head. Had to fly Stewie to town and sew up his head. So Carlo called, Bill Carlo just called in the state troopers for an investigation. Wiesner has some blonde gal working there, living there with him. He also had a fellow named Levi Foote He's a former Loomis security guard. Talked to Levi later, a couple days later, and he said that he'd been up there in 1966 and knew, had worked for Wiesner, and he was interested in buying the place from him. But the villagers were all buzzing about this altercation that Wiesner was afraid, had this security policeman there, and the Carlos were giving the Wiesner store a wide berth. I don't know what's going to happen on that. Bill said when he goes in to pay his bill, he's going to wear his gun on us when he goes in, just in case Wiesner gets gun happy again. Bill Carlo was born in Rampart in 1915. His father, I don't know his first name, his father's, or his last name, but his first name was, or middle name was Carlo. The children took the name Carlo as the last name. At any rate, Bill's father and Emil Noddy's father and Dominic Vernetti came to Alaska together from Sicily. And Bill lived in Rampart until 1930. He was 15 years old when he left. I detect a little bit of not standoffishness, but just a little bit of can't think of the adjective. At any rate, Carlo is one of the hardest working men I've ever seen. He's mined gold. He's mining, well, he's got a sluicing operation this summer at Hunter Creek on property he owns, but he's spending most of his time working on the road, the 4-mile road contract he has. But he's a very enterprising, hardworking Indian, and has a very, very fine wife, a very successful family. They own their own home in Fairbanks. Bill learned to fly years ago, over 20 years ago, and he's been flying in and out of villages and mining sites up to the North Slope. You name it, he's been there. I think there are 9 children altogether in the Carlo family. They're all good citizens, hardworking, earn their own way, not on welfare. Quite a change from the average villager. Might just be a little bit of jealousy there on the villager's part, but at the same time, it might be a little bit of admiration, too. I don't know. I don't want to get into this. Don't know enough about it to discuss it. But I do know the Carlos are really fine people. There are 5 mining operations in Rampart as of 1st of August 1973. I don't know the extent of the operations, and I expect they're all rather modest. The Jakovich operation probably is the most ambitious. But here are the ones who are mining. Ira Wiesner, Harry Havrilock, Havrilock, who's the commissioner, the Carlos, Milo Jakovich, and Kosta Melnikov. Melnikov is a Russian by birth and came to the United States, entered the armed services during World War II, and was granted his U.S. citizenship for his service in the military. He's now a U.S. citizen. Wiesner is mining on Hosey Creek. Havrilock is on Ruby Creek. Jakovich and Carlo are on Hunter Creek. Doggone if I know where Melnikov is mining, which one he's on. I just don't know. Fort Yukon Air Service services Rampart 3 times a week as of this date, as of August 1973. Plane leaves Fairbanks Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. It goes into Rampart. Sometimes it stops at Stevens Village. Quite a few people fly their own aircraft in. Pete Murray has been in and out all summer. His wife, Renee, was born and reared in Rampart. She goes over every summer and catches lots of fish, cans a lot, dries a lot, makes dried smoked salmon, canned salmon. The United States Commissioner, as I mentioned before, is Harry Havrilock. And I have a tape, separate tape on him, so I won't go into too much detail. But Harry came to the Yukon Drainage, in 1934. He's been commissioner since about 1951, when he replaced Kitty Harwood. At that time, Kitty moved into Fairbanks because her children were of high school age and she wanted them to be able to go to high school. And Kitty had been commissioner up until that time. In fact, Kitty said that she recorded the birth of her twin daughters there in Rampart. It's unusual. The mother acting as recorder and recording her twins' birth. Harry Havrilock has built a three-room, let's see, it's one, two, three-room is on the main floor, this log structure with a frame addition, which is a summer-type kitchen and storeroom. Then it has an upstairs, which I did not see. The downriver side is used as his courtroom. The center portion is his kitchen, living room, and then a separate small bedroom. He built the place after the 1963 flood that jammed so much ice up in the Yukon River in that area, that as more ice came down the Yukon, it jammed up and packed up and was forced up over the river ice and eventually up over the bank, wiped out the first row of cabins in the village. For some unknown reason, it skipped about three structures, one of which is the old trading post that Ira Wiesner runs. That was built about 1906, according to one of the villagers. And then an adjoining warehouse seemed to be untouched. And then an old building built by the Army Signal Corps and is now used for the storage of old records, commissioner's records. And it was even used by Judge Wickersham when he made the circuit and had held court in Rampart many, many years ago. Those three buildings were not touched, though there were other large buildings in Rampart, two-story large structures that were just completely demolished. Harry said he used logs from demolished structures to build his place. In this old Signal Corps building, there are records there which I read through and which I made 7 or 8 tapes from, just reading the entries, names, dates. There must be 30 or 35 volumes, some large volumes, maybe 3 or 4 inches thick and 16 inches by 20 inches. Huge old volumes that contain handwritten entries. No typewriters in those days. At least there wasn't a typewriter in Rampart. No loose-leaf notebooks. And of course no Xerox machines, so everything was in original and it was handwritten. Some of these documents have been microfilmed by the state court system. Many of them, however, have never been photographed. some records that I read through and have recorded on other Rampart tapes that are in this collection had some of the most beautiful script writing I've ever seen, and I photographed that. But the pages were not flat, because the flood of 1963, or the ice jam of 1963, forced maybe 5.5 or close to 6 feet of water into this building and damaged quite a few of the books, though some of them were so tightly bound and tightly pressed together that the water didn't penetrate, which is a miracle. To get back to Wiesner and my missing him on this trip, I stopped off at the store soon after we arrived in Rampart, and of course it was a mail day, so a lot of the children were in waiting for their mail, and this gal who works for Wiesner plus Levi were there in the post office part of the store, just a small section of the store that's boarded off into the so-called Rampart Post Office. Mr. Wiesner was busy on the counter, where he usually is exchanging groceries for money. He was writing out some postal money orders. I waited and waited and waited, didn't interrupt. Finally, Levi came around to ask what I wanted, and I told him that I was in town to do some taping for the Historical Society, and I wanted to talk to Ira Wiesner and get some information from him. So he said that he was awfully busy, he'd come back in about an hour. So the Muckluck Telegraph must have preceded me, because I came walking in town with Bill Carlo and Ann Carlo, who had this holster and gun belt and with a gun in it slung over her shoulder, and apparently they must have thought that I was there to do some investigating for the Carlos. About 45 minutes later, I decided I'd go back to the store to see if Mr. Wiesner had time to talk, or at least if I could speak to him briefly and set up an appointment. I started walking down the main street, which is just a path on the banks of the river. And right in front of Wiesner's store was a D8 cat with Wiesner sitting in the seat. And pretty soon the blonde comes out and handed up a huge purse, pocketbook, to Wiesner. He grabbed it. And she climbed up aboard the D8 cat, and he scooted over in the seat, and she sat down, and off they went. So I never did get to talk to Wiesner, never said a word to him. When I went back later to the store and talked to Levi, he said, well, he won't be back for a week or 10 days. His gold diggings are about 8 or 10 miles up Minook Creek and then off of Minook Creek, so there's no transportation in Rampart except walking, so that was too far for me to carry a heavy tape recorder. This recorder probably weighs 40 pounds when it's all loaded with microphones and batteries and stuff. Get back to the records in the commissioner's office. Some of them date back to 1898 and 99 and 1900. These certainly should be preserved, and they should be resting in a waterproof, fireproof location like the university archives. I spoke to Margaret Harris about this as soon as I got back. I'm going to talk to Paul McCarthy, who's the archivist at the university, and perhaps we can write to the state and have the state, if they don't retrieve these volumes, at least microfilm what is there. The reason there are no records prior to 1898 is that each creek during the stampede had its own recorder. This information came from Harry Haverlock, the commissioner. And these books, along with some of the other volumes, have been called in by the state judicial system, apparently to settle claims on properties in that area, on title searches, etc. But Harry Haverlock told me that each creek, Slate Creek, Hunter Creek, Minook, Ruby Creek, all of these creeks that were very active during the stampede, had its own recorder, an own set of recordings. These are not in Rampart now, so I wasn't able to look at any of those. I enjoyed looking at the 1898, 99, 1900, and on up through 1905 and 6 court proceedings, some recording of deeds, a couple of marriages that were recorded. These also were recorded in another volume on just devoted to marriages, but for some reason or other they wanted them recorded in the official recorder's book. Also, there's a book there on births and deaths. I'm not sure about the deaths. I didn't see one on that, but I think it's there. To sum it all up, it's a terrifically valuable historical collection that should be preserved. Hopefully that building can be made a historic site by the state. Hopefully those volumes can be microfilmed soon. Sooner the better.